Hey, movie lovers, get out your history books because we're talking about The Post. It's all things Nixon, Watergate, and so much in the Vietnam War history. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep team up for this Oscar contender as we continue our award season run here on Anatomy of a Movie. We have Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
Dimitri Panos.
Hey, movie fans. What's happening, folks? How's everybody doing?
Doing good. Talking movies. Steven Spielberg directed this one. Lots to talk about. A couple things administratively for you guys. First off, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just joining us for the first time, welcome. If you're returning, welcome back. Either way, welcome. First and foremost, we are spoiler filled. We assume you've seen the movie. We assume you may also know history, so that kind of gives away the movie a little bit. Nonetheless, you've been warned. And as always, if you want to follow our rundown in the description box, just click that link. It's a PDF, and you can follow along with our research and so forth as we talk about these various things. And because I gave the spoiler warning, I'll also say this. There's a great quote in this movie that says, newspapers are like the first draft of history. And we are like the first draft of talking about this movie, at least in our terms, because you guys also get to participate and comment along and give us your thoughts. And that's the beauty of all of it, isn't it? Let us begin with quick thoughts. Marissa.
So I went into this film expecting a very Spielberg movie, and it certainly was. It was good. I did not love it, but it's a very solid film. Good acting from, you know, Tom Hanks, Meryl Streep, of course, they're A-list actors. And then Spielberg, I think he does a great job of telling his story and telling and showing the direction of going from point A to point B. There were some cinematography shots I was like, oh yeah, that's so Spielberg. But I think there were some moments that kind of was anticlimactic for me in the story building up and then, okay, that's it. That was the result, and we'll definitely get into it. I like the look of it. It was saturated. It was gray, as you can tell by the graphic behind us. It's a very gray, time period type of film. It's good. I didn't love it though.
All right. Dimitri?
I actually really did enjoy this movie. I think it's a fantastic prequel to All the President's Men. And I think it also, not that there was a trilogy ever designed, but in my own mind, I mean, within the past couple of years, we got that movie Spotlight. Should be no surprise that the writer of Spotlight was brought in here for writing
journalism
on The Post, because it had that journalistic that pro journalism, that love of journalism and research that was in here, because this is what this movie's about. It's a doing.
And he
a
also
lot
did
of,
the West Wing for a number of years, so right. Combined that too.
Yeah, and you could tell, and it's really done very well here. This wasn't a part of history that I was familiar with. And what to me was the most fascinating is how relevant this movie is in today's society, in today's landscape, with trying to suppress the press and women's and women figuring into power. And I just found that so fascinating, being that this was in the early 70s. And I love those topics. And I really loved how it's scary to me that if the events in this movie, The Post, didn't turn out the way that you would hoped, things in history would be a hell of a lot different today. Beginning with Watergate, we wouldn't know the term Watergate if the powers that be won. So I find that to be very scary indeed, particularly when you juxtapose it with today's society. The performances, I thought, were top-notch, from top to bottom as well. The look of the movie was fantastic. The detail to me was great too. I loved looking at the printing press, right? You know, there's no papers today. You don't need necessarily a printing press to get newspapers out. A lot of it's done online. And what I just appreciated going back and seeing the way papers, like the typeset, putting those bars in, the inks, putting it down and then running off the papers. Spielberg captured that fantastically, just as well as he captured these events and how they unfolded right into what became Watergate. So I think it's monumental to note that there was a woman in charge and that this decision, this key decision, led into another major key decision which shaped and formed our history to today.
Fair enough. I overall enjoyed this movie. You know, there's a lot of comparisons sort of being made between The Post and Darkest Hour. I enjoyed this movie better than Darkest Hour. Both are historical films. Maybe this is more of an American movie than a British one. And I enjoyed it. I thought, you know, I know I did a lot of research about Watergate for a long time in high school and college. And so I like that side of, I don't like the history, but I enjoy learning about it.
Can I ask you, like, was this
who keeps hitting their mic, by the way?
I don't know.
All right.
Was this something that you learned about too while you were researching Watergate in high school? Like the events that unfolded in this movie and in history?
About McNamara, yes, but not specifically about The Post.
Yeah.
This was a very isolated version of it. And what I appreciate about it is very kinesthetic in the sense it takes place over a couple of days, maybe a few weeks, but nonetheless things are happening. What I appreciate about it, if you kind of track the movie, Catherine's real decisions, she's really only kind of makes a couple of turns and key decisions like three or four times, but it's all these other players playing into that, and that's what I sort of appreciated was this large scale involvement of the everyday man. You know, first it's scanning the papers, then it's Odenkirk's character getting the papers. It's also Tom Hanks' character, Bradley, of doing what he does, also eventually leads to this final decision that she has to make. And it boils down to that. So I appreciated it a lot, you know. And I think I have not actually seen All the President's Men, but the final shot is pretty much a shot-for-shot remake of the beginning of that one, which is pretty cool.
You haven't seen All the President's Men.
There's a lot of movies.
And you've researched Watergate?
There's a lot of movies I haven't seen. We'd be here all day if I told you all the movies I have yet to see.
No, but I'm just, for somebody who researched Watergate, I mean, All the President's Men is one of those, well, it's one of those seminal movies that comes out. And again, it's one of those, too, like even when we talked about Spotlight, you know, it's a movie that you can't help but reference, but particularly in this bubble of history where all those, from a journalistic standpoint, were so important to... What was that quote that you said at the beginning?
The newspaper is the first draft of history.
Yeah, it's the first draft of history. And how to today, too, how it relates to today, it's just phenomenal. It's very... It's uncanny and scary.
Well, here's... So... Maybe we kick it off like this. We've talked about a lot of movies that have been historic, and you can check them all out in our library. But oftentimes we debate how valid they need to be to the history. And something like this, there's a lot of people going around. In fact, let's see. On PBS NewsHour, Goodell said that although a producer has artistic license, it should be limited in a situation such as this so that the public comes away with an understanding of what the true facts are in this case. And I think that if you're going to do a movie now when President Donald Trump is picking on the press for fake news, you have to be as authentic as you can be. You don't want it to be fake in any way. The reason I bring that up is because the only sort of criticism of this movie is it downplays the role of the New York Times, which in fact did win a Pulitzer Prize for releasing these Pentagon Papers. And yet the movie makes it seem like it was really the Washington Post that had a heavier hand in perhaps in all of this.
Yeah, and you, I mean, do you have to give a testament to the New York Times? They the one were the ones who kickstarted it, but it was also the Washington Post who were the ones who finished it, essentially. So, and they did play their key role, but unfortunately, you know, the law got the best of them, because if they didn't have that, I forget what you call it, the injunction, I guess, against them, where they had to legally stop, they would have kept going. And it would have been called the New York Times, not the Post. So, and that'd be a completely different film. But I did like how it does show that because they are newspapers, it is a smaller industry. Everyone knows each other, and it's a smaller community. But they were all working together essentially to tell the same story. I like that solidarity in a way.
Yeah, I mean, and to your point regarding the New York Times, I mean. And the Post was on the verge of just going away, and I think that's part of the I think that's a key factor in this movie. There was a lot more at stake for the Washington Post at the time than there was for, say, the New York Times. And granted, they did get that Pulitzer for releasing those papers. But had it not been for the Washington Post to pick up that baton where the New York Times couldn't. And it made careers out of Bradley Graham and the Washington Post, and only boosted the New York Times as well. That to me is like where the crux of the story lies, because there really was so much at stake, you know. And again, that a woman who makes this decision and charges on when she's in a boardroom filled with men who are contradicting most everything that she's trying to do, and she still carries on and fights on. I thought that was amazing and should be looked at in today's world. Yeah. As well.
We'll certainly dive in deep there. As far as my thoughts on it, it's not like they're disrespecting the New York Times. They have to be enemy, and they're not even enemies. They're just competitors, simply because of the nature of the game, mm-hmm. as they say. But it's not. They're not saying the Times is evil. They just want to get the scoop that the New York Times is taking. And not to sort of – this is my own sort of viewpoint. But I think as things get global, I actually – really think that all these major papers, whether the Post, the Times, and the LA Times, and then you can spread it throughout the world, should be, because of where they're located in the backyard of wherever, should have a huge hand in sort of reporting that, because it is a global effect. So the Post as far as Washington, LA as far as entertainment, New York as far as the stock market, and I don't know, I can't think of other stuff. I'm Chicago Tribune as far as things going on in Chicago, deep dish pizza, I don't know. But anyway, so I think it'll be interesting to see how newspapers go on through the years. But since we brought up the subject of Catherine, let's talk about her. You know, I think ultimately she wins out as a very strong woman. But it's interesting how they played her, because it's not like she always has the strength to begin with and just people are shutting her down. In that initial boardroom, yes, I get her trepidation as far as all the people not really making even eye contact with her, but she doesn't step up to the plate and say her script that she's been rehearsing for days.
Right.
So what did you guys take, you know, as far as her journey?
I love Meryl Streep as an actress. I've seen so many of her films, and she's an amazing actress. This one, I feel like, yeah, she played a quote-unquote strong woman, but I don't think it's one of the stronger roles that we've seen of women as of late. Yeah, she was put in a hard position to make such a drastic decision that could tank her entire business that her family has built. That I can understand the pressure, and she did a great job showing that. But the moment when she actually made the decision, she was even, like, wary of it. She's like, yeah, let's do it. I was like, if you're going to make such a strong decision, have some conviction behind it. And, like, I love Meryl Streep, but I just didn't feel like this moment really sold as, oh, this woman's awesome. She made an amazing decision. No, she made a decision because she was being pressured.
So, yeah, I couldn't disagree with that assessment anymore. I felt that that scene was amazing when she had to make that decision. And her character arc, again, I thought it was the great bait and switch, because we see her practicing that speech and she did it so strong and forcefully until she got into the meeting and she just became frail and she couldn't even talk. And then that character being pressured to not make that decision that she eventually makes, that she has to toil about, like, what am I going to do? Like, I could do something that is going to put me in ruins, that the paper is going to be gone, it could be curses for me. And I felt that that scene was the key scene. Now, Meryl Streep, I think, is a very strong actress. She's obviously the queen of Hollywood. But that one scene, then I understand, okay, I get why she got nominated here. To me, that scene was, well, that's the linchpin of the movie. It's making this decision to go forward. Everybody was against her for printing and going along. And she had to fight all of those opinions, with the exception of Tom Hanks, who wanted them to go forward.
And the writers. Here, the writers were certainly on her side.
Yeah, and it was... This is one of those decisions that, you know, if it went down that way, which we won't know, it wasn't in that room. But again, it's one of those pinpoint decisions that really changed everything. And I felt that scene was handled just, I thought it's for that was my favorite moment of her performance in the entire movie, mm-hmm. for me.
Yeah. You know, to be honest, Marissa, I think what's interesting. Obviously, I want nothing but strong role models for women and so forth. But I think, to be honest, a man in that decision would have acted in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's, to me, that's the real beauty of it. It is an extremely hard decision. In a sense, you're kind of just like, all right, I just got to go with my gut and just kind of go and leave it at that. And that's what I appreciate about it is, it, you know, as much as it was a woman making that big decision, I don't think a guy would have handled it any differently.
Yeah, it's... And I love strong women, and like you always hear me preach about strong characters in every Anatomy show we did. But I just felt like, I think I just got so tired leading up to this moment where every man was turning her down and like giving any excuse to go against her decision, because it just seems like they didn't respect her whatsoever. They didn't give her enough respect that she deserved for keeping on a business that only she got by her laurels and by being married to the man who started it. And so, like, you can just tell throughout the whole movie that the men didn't respect her whatsoever. And then to have the audacity of making her have the actual decision in the end, it was like, it just seemed really contrived. And I know this is based on history, but just watching it, I think I just, as a woman, was already frustrated for her, and she made a decision that, yeah, it was a big decision. It was great. It was a great moment in the film. It was a pivotal moment in the scene. But it was very frustrating to watch.
And I think so many different factors. This is so many factors, I believe, too, where the characters had to change, including hers. And this is something, too, that this movie brings up. That not many do, not like journalistic movies, but this movie really makes a point of it, and I was very fascinated by this too, is their relationships within Washington. Her and her family's relationship with McNamara. Bradley's relationship with Kennedy. And how that can possibly sway how you write about a particular person, and the dialogue that Bradley and Graham had about those relationships made both characters think about, going forward, what do I have to do? I have to change a little. And to me, that too was just one of those factors that led to her decision making. In that, and again, it's not something that we see a lot of in these movies about press and how press can be. We know how press can be colored, right? But it's the relationships that these journalists have with, like, I didn't realize how close she was with McNamara, and in a sense, she was trying to shield him. Maybe not, you know. But when you factor in what's happening today, It's like, of course. That's what the scary parallels are crazy. But I'm glad that this movie brought that up, and because that is journalistic integrity.
Yeah, and that's what she made her crux on going into the IPO. They said we have a, you know, one of our missions is to serve the American public in the best way that we can. And, you know, to that scene of McNamara when he's saying, like, this study was done so it could be understood years from now when it's all in hindsight. Like, okay, but no, I got to do what I have to do. And I sort of appreciated that there's that fine line between friendship and, but if you're a journalist, you know, you, if something is said in confidence, yeah, you kind of don't necessarily want it to taint, but if you get wind of something else and unfortunately hurts your relationship, you have to, that's your job, unfortunately. Yeah. You've kind of taken that oath.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah, you're right in that sense that both Bradley and her, that was ultimately their arc.
Right.
You know.
Did you find it interesting at all within the opening of the movie? We're taking, what was it, Air Force One, or yep, whatever, back to the States, back to D.C. And Mac, they bring in that journalist guy who talks
Daniel.
To Mac, Daniel, and he talks to McNamara, and he just shoots him the truth. And McNamara goes, damn it, that's what I've been saying, that's what I've been telling him. And for like 2 minutes, they made McNamara look like a good guy until he got off the plane. And he totally contradicted. And they're sitting there watching and going, who are you? But I liked how, again, they do this juxtapositioning of, yeah, I see what you're saying, but I can't go out publicly and say that. Like, I have to back my president. I can't say what you're saying. I have to go by other means. Again, it was just another subtle detail when you watch this movie. And his Bruce Greenwood's performance as McNamara was fantastic too. I thought it was very good.
He did a really good job. Yeah. As far as, so it was Daniel Ellsberg, the real Daniel Ellsberg, who kind of kicked this off, and he walked out with the Pentagon Papers. And as he says in his memoir, he took a very calculated risk because his bag never got checked by security. But then again, he also didn't know the true policy of whether or not he was allowed to take papers or not. So, just for future reference, if you have top secret documents, create a policy.
Right. But if they had that policy, then none of this would have happened.
Right.
So, I did like that. I think Matthew Rhys is an amazing actor, too. I mean, if you watch The Americans, he's amazing. And he mm-hmm. plays an awesome spy. Mm-hmm. So to see him kind of play somewhat of a secretive character who has a big secret and, you know, doing this all under the nose of the government, of like, wow, this guy has balls. Like, I gotta appreciate him for doing all that.
Yeah.
But it also takes a strong guy to realize that there is an issue and we need to get this addressed. If it's not coming from him, someone else has to say it.
Right.
And I like that he had the nerve to have that bravery and courage to scan all those documents. Oh, take months.
The patience.
Take months to do this.
Right.
You know, I applaud him.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd have the patience in today's day and age with right, scanners are right. much faster.
Right.
But to do it one by one, and those thousands.
Over, right.
And to also individually cut top right. secret off of every yes. single page. I mean, yeah. that took
I know,
time.
He didn't even use like a paper, like stack a bunch
no,
up and use a paper cutter. But again, talking about that particular scene, and there are a couple of others, you know, it's when you're doing a movie about journalism, it can be tough to build suspense on certain things. We talked about that a lot in Spotlight. How do you make research exciting for 2 hours, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this movie made journalism and writing and going to the presses, it made it exciting. It brought a sense of like suspense. Is he going to get out of that building with those things? And that's another thing that I found to be engaging in this movie, as engaging as Spotlight was. And you know, All the President's Men is truly an engaging movie with that. So I appreciate trying to take something that could be considered sort of boring and you make it palpable, you make it exciting.
Well, you know, that they built up the stakes in a really great way. As far as, you know, we continue the rivalry between the New York Times and them. As Bradley says, like, anyone here tired of reading the news instead of doing it?
Right.
And so that it just kind of set it so... I get it. It wasn't meant to be funny, but it was funny as an audience member of like, yeah, you guys are just losing and get to it.
Right.
And so they did a good job of interspersing moments like that to really get it going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They also did a good job of just showing us the process of like whose hands the story goes to first before, like, once you have it written, it goes to the editor. Once it goes to the editor, right, it goes to this guy. And then it goes to this guy down in press. You know, like, I think they actually did a good job of showing the process of who does all the checks and balances before any story hits the papers.
And getting the newsroom together.
Yeah. It's like, that's cool. That was it. Yes.
And something for, like, this is when they have to get the lawyer's involvement. So the whole idea of that, A, the government is against you. B, you can't leak anything secret that might actually damage, you know, the integrity and safety of the American people.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I also liked, you know, showing the competitiveness of the same Pentagon paper stories. Like, the source could be the same, which can also put you also in the same trouble as New York Times.
Right.
That was a good element to be like, oh, this is serious, mm-hmm, of what we got our hands on.
And it was such a multifaceted story. Just prior to when we went, you know, go time here, you know, you were talking about Odenkirk, right?
Mm-hmm.
His performance, really for me too, comes out of nowhere. He was so brilliant in that role. But his story is different from our main story because he's the guy that's following breadcrumbs, even sometimes when there are no breadcrumbs, and to say they meet a dead end, he's in a brick wall, and it's how can I overcome this? His story was equally as fascinating, and the way that he played it, both in the newsroom and outside of the newsroom, I thought was fantastic and a great thread to follow through, because everything just comes together. He was great. An Illinois person, as you...
Yeah, Illinois. Yeah. Illinois native.
And it was just the subtleties of everything. Like, him dropping the coins and then dropping the phone and having to pick it up. Like, hey, hold on, I got a notepad. Hold on.
Right, that was a painful scene to watch. I was like, oh, I'm so glad we don't have pay phones anymore. Whew.
But even, you know, you could... The irony is you could substitute it in a completely different number of ways. In today's day and age, but
also showed the length of that character, what he was willing to do and go through just to find the source of, like, what his journalistic integrity and the lengths he did as a writer, as a journalist. Yeah.
And it all started with a lot like, oh, well, I know somebody, let me try that. You know, and his tenacity was just very well played out, where you were rooting for him. And if he hit a roadblock, you're like, damn, you know. But you're right, the detail in, like, trying to write, it's like, god damn it, I dropped it.
It's like
it.
Google wasn't around, so you actually had to go to the person that you knew.
Absolutely.
True.
It's the old school way of finding information.
Yep.
Let's talk about, I know it's a smaller thing, but I thought interesting enough, Bradley and his wife. Because, you know, in the midst of all of this, she's just so supporting of her husband, and, you know, not even that, like, he's not even home often, but then when he is home, he invites everybody, and it's just a bombardment, and that would be bad enough, and you could say, like, okay, she's just going to be a little bit distant. No, she makes some sandwiches, So I thought, you know, so let's talk about that.
I'm glad you brought up Darkest Hours, because that's what Tony Bradley, played by Sarah Paulson, somewhat reminded me of Evie?
Clementine.
Of Clementine.
Clementine.
You know, I mean, very supportive. Knew her husband's world and what it meant to the press, but what it meant for him to be a family man. And she accepted him for who she was and all of his colleagues. Sarah Paulson, I thought, was really good in that role. And she kept... In a sense, she helped keep things together for the family. Yeah, and the scene where she's making him sandwiches was really great. And it wasn't because she was ordered to necessarily. It wasn't like she was being. She was like, "Hey, these people need some food, and I'm going to be part of the. I'm going to be part of this."
Yeah, and that's when I look at the movie as a whole. That's what I meant when I said I appreciate everyone's contribution in all of this.
Right. I like Sarah Paulson. She's an amazing actress as well in every freaking thing that she does. Such a small minor role, but also important to Bradley, because you can tell that it weighs heavily on him as a person, on their family. He's hardly home. And when he does home, he's working. So, but it also takes a strong woman to just understand what he does and everything that he goes through. So I like that small minor role. Could have easily been played by someone else too, but Sarah's just great.
But here's the thing, small minor role, except for the most pivotal moment when she gut checks him, like, "Hey, listen, you have nothing to lose here, buddy. So F you if you think your head is on the chopping block."
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know? Like, you can get another job. You're good. It's her. Right. That loses everything. He's like, "Oh crap."
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she had her moment too. But if you were going to make comparisons to Clementine had more emotional moments with Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
That were way more understanding as a wife. I think she was saying that more as a wife for a career, but not as a person.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying. I just, again, I always comparing them to as that emotional support, being there, understanding their husband's world and what it means. And still, both characters, strong women characters, good women characters, and they contributed amazingly. Like, Churchill's wife wasn't making sandwiches, but she did gut check him. She was his conscience, right? And in this movie, that's a pivotal dialogue, that's the parallel I'm drawing.
Yeah.
Paulson, hey, perhaps maybe somebody else could have played it, but Paulson, it was good to see her in this role, and she did it really well, and I bought the chemistry. More importantly, I bought the chemistry.
I was trying to get over the age difference, but okay. Yeah. I didn't really see the chemistry, but it was good.
I mean, it wasn't, I wouldn't like categorize it as a rom-com, but I saw love. I mean, no, yeah, in all seriousness, like, it's not your stereotypical, like, "Oh my God, I love you, you're so sweet." But it was, you know, to me, it was a far deeper and more meaningful type of love.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I definitely appreciated that. Where did I want to talk about next? Let's talk about the board, if you will, or whatever you want to call it, the opposition. We want to get the IPO, but all the board,
the Washington Post board. Yeah. You know,
I mean, it's always interesting because at the end of the day, like, as far as the way they criticized Catherine for not having an intimate knowledge of the quote newspaper business, it seemed like they had far less of it to begin with.
Yeah, and there were moments where, like, I was rooting for Catherine because she is the only woman in the room. She's clearly the smartest person in the room, but yet she doesn't have the assertiveness to actually speak up against the men. And that's so true in today's age. 75% of women don't speak up when they're surrounded by men. It's so effing true. So when she did it, she had all the notes written down. She had moments where she was wording everything that she wanted to say before someone else said it. I'm like, come on, woman, just speak up. And that's why I was like, Meryl Streep, I love her. She's an amazing actress. And she, like, there were moments where Catherine, you can tell she was a strong woman, but she wasn't strong enough. And this was a moment where I'm like, come on, girl, if you want to get any respect from any of your colleagues, you speak up.
And I think by the end, that's her arc. I think she becomes the woman that we at least got that glimpse of when she was practicing her speech. Because, again, you don't know who the hell she's talking to, right? At the
beginning, you're going, but, like, wow, she had forceful. All the percentages and all the notes, every information, and then it was the guy next to her saying everything word for word.
He stepped in when she just clammed up.
Yeah.
Somebody had to.
I was rooting for her. I was like, this is a moment where you could have been strong.
But she needed, at that point, she just needed a victory. Right? And so he, listen, the way he looked at her, he knew he was, like, they practiced the speech together, and he wanted her to give the speech.
He told her that, yeah. You say it exactly like that, you've won. You've done it. You can't make it any more perfect. You're perfect at it. So, and I don't think, like, at the beginning, that guy, was that Fritz?
Right? I believe
Fritz.
So.
And so, at the beginning, you really did feel that Fritz was her major supporter, right? And confidant. He just sort of kind of, like, then, like, going towards the middle, you're like, oh, Fritz, you're just so letting her down. Like, how can you not support her at this really hard time? But at least at the beginning, he was, like, going, come on, Catherine, you have to stand up for yourself. Know that I'm always there. But he was more or less, you have to stand up. You can do this. And when she cowered, you're like, oh. And I felt that to me, okay, well, this is her journey, so that when she does finally, she stands up to Arthur Parsons, she stands up to Fritz and everybody else, that to me was the victory. And that to me, and when she was in the courtroom, and those women and that girl, they looked up to her. That to me, that was a great moment in this movie. And it spoke volumes.
And that was the interesting part. As they're walking out, the New York Times is being interviewed, and they're like, do you want to say something? We've said enough. So it's knowledge of knowing when to say what.
Yeah, and like the knowing when words aren't needed. And I loved when she did walk out because she was off on the side, and the line that she parts was all woman. And
right.
I actually enjoyed that. That was a good shining moment for her.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great scene. And the way that it was filmed, too, visually, was very...
It was all women looking up to her.
Yep.
It's like, okay, she can be a role model.
Yep.
In
basically at the time, too, a very man's world. And when you talk about the board, right, we can't forget that we are talking about New York. Whether they knew about the news or how to present the news, that's not what they cared about. They cared about the bottom line and how we can make money, how we get the stock, how we get this IPO up. That's what their concern was. Journalism integrity? Pah. Whatever. Like, how do we build this IPO?
Well, that was not that I want to get too far into it, simply because I don't even understand it too much, but where they were going for a lower price and Catherine was actually arguing for a higher price so they can get more writers. So it was interesting in that way. You would think that they would be the ones fighting for a higher initial price.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, again, I don't know too much about it, so we won't go into it.
Okay.
All right. So any other sort of themes that you guys want to talk about? Because I think we've touched upon a lot of them, and as we talk about the behind the scenes, that'll draw out more. But if there's something story-wise pertinent that you absolutely want to talk about, we can do it now.
No, I think
so. All right. So since we kicked off with Kay, I'll kick it off with Kay from the behind the scenes. Meryl Streep did not know that Steven Spielberg doesn't rehearse with his actors. And Tom Hanks was well aware of this, as you may imagine, and he didn't want to tell her. But nonetheless, as you can see, they got along quite well, and it ended up working just fine.
Sure.
Which is funny. You would think, like, that they would... You know, Steven Spielberg's done so many movies, and Meryl Streep's been in the business so often, that so long, that you would think that she would at least know that about him.
Somebody that she knows everybody, somebody who she knows, who friends with, right, would have said, oh, yeah, no, I just finished this Spielberg movie. Wow, he's so, you know, he doesn't even rehearse. Oh, that's nice. I agree with you.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
But I think it just shows that she's such a veteran actress. It's like, yeah, and you might be shocked in the moment, but she rolled with it, and you can tell. I mean, it didn't really affect her performance.
No.
So.
I mean, let's look at this here. I mean, we are looking at some of the elder statesmen of cinema today. You know, Steven Spielberg, doing this for 40 plus years, Tom Hanks as well, Meryl Streep. They've each played and directed various types of movies. Putting these people together, not only does it make sense, but it's a testament to their professionalism. So you know that Meryl Streep is like, oh, no rehearsal? Okay, well, however you want, Stephen. And you know, yeah Meryl, I'm sure you can handle it. Yeah, okay.
But even the cast around them, again, Bob Odenkirk, I mean, very... I don't want to call him an underrated actor, but I don't think he's finally getting the praise that he... Bradley Whitford, he's been around for a long time. So they're all very knowledgeable and so forth, and they did quite a fantastic job all around, every single person.
And when they started, like, Odenkirk, too, is a comedy-ish kind of guy. Right? Mm-hmm. Now look at the movies. You know, Bradley Whitford Duke. And you know, he always had he was in an Aaron Sorkin. Was it West Wing or was it... I think it was West Wing that he was in. So he's no stranger to professionalism and dialogue-driven. But he's also played asshole characters before, yeah. Right? Yeah, right? Yeah. So... But you're right. You're putting together these elder statesmen, these people who are seasoned, and that set must have been just completely different than Ready Player One, let's say, right?
Well, interestingly enough, as similar to Schindler's List and Jurassic Park, as Ready Player One was finishing up due to its long post process. Spielberg intercut his time between shooting this and essentially finishing that.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, to the point that we've hit upon of how it's very similar to today's day and age, Spielberg felt very much the same way, and so he wanted to get this movie out as quickly as possible. And in fact, from pre-production, shooting to post, 9 months. That's incredible.
It's a humongous fast turnaround for him.
Considering he had shot Ready Player One first,
yeah,
working on special effects, he didn't need another project, but when he read about the project, he was like, fine. Meryl Streep was pretty much on board before even Spielberg was. But the mere fact that where do they find the hours in the day? and then having to do... special effects for Ready Player One, which looks like it'll be just gorgeous, but, you know, effects driven, much like Jurassic as opposed to Schindler's List. It's crazy. And he wasn't even thinking about doing that movie until he found this story and Liz's writing, Premise and Critical Study, Beautiful Personal Portrait of Graham got me to say, I might be crazy, but I think I'm going to make another movie right now. Yeah. And all it took for him was that seed of a story. And you're right. I think the timing probably helped, too, of this story in today's world.
And it's Spielberg, you know. To me, the more amazing part is, he did the movie and it's complete, but the artistry that really is behind it, and we'll sort of break that down in terms of the editing and the production of it. That's amazing. It really is an Oscar-worthy movie.
Yeah. And he was in Italy. Christy Mikosko-Krieger has worked with Spielberg for a couple of decades now. She goes, we just turned everything around in a day. I called everybody and said, let's wrap it up in Italy. We're going to make a movie in New York in 11 weeks. 11 weeks, you're bringing this crew over. But he's pulled it off, and you're right. I mean, it's the man's imagination and visual artistry of storytelling is really unparalleled. There's only people like Martin Scorsese. I mean, they're all within this certain... I mean, they all sort of came up together. He's just the artistry of it all. Is amazing, and at his age too, you know, that he keeps on going, and it's just what he's done.
Well,
it's amazing.
What I appreciate about him is, I mean, at this point he's done. He has the experience. B, I don't know, at a certain point, you do things to prevent yourself from being bored. I don't know. I'm only speculating. At least for me, that's how. I've seen multiple like behind the scenes where he's shooting one thing, but he's already telling them how to set up the next thing.
Right.
And boom, 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 and that's how he's able to just be so fast.
Yeah, you know,
right. And Spielberg has an amazing documentary.
HBO.
Right. We were talking about
absolutely.
It's amazing, and like Spielberg, he's just such a director. Like, he has a vision. He is a visual director where, I mean, we talked about it when we were doing Close Encounter of the Third Kind.
Right.
Like, he has such an eye for detail, and he just knows how things are going to flow from one thing to the next. So to turn around an entire movie from beginning to end in 9 months is like, yeah, that's Spielberg. Because he just knows how everything's going to flow. And like, that's just the artist that he is. Like, mm-hmm. he can tell a story and put a puzzle together so quick. You know, you have to plot him, and he's done it for years. He's the reason why we have the word blockbuster.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I, if you haven't seen the documentary, go check it out.
Yeah, it's
literally
HBO.
Called Spielberg.
Yeah, and HBO on demand if you have HBO. Yeah, but yeah, fantastic. I was going to mention how you and I were talking at some length about that documentary, because you do get into an insight as to how the man works. But, you know, just to get into a little bit of his history, you know, starting by doing TV, whether it was Hitchcock, Presents and whatnot, and making his leap into movies, and the way his thought process is, and how to put a camera and where to put it, and how he visually tracks things, which is great. It's a dynamic, and it's one that. It's hard pressed that we'll ever see. I'm glad that he continues to make movies. I was particularly thrilled to death that he was doing Ready Player One, because that's such. I wanted a throwback Spielberg movie, and that the book is a throwback Spielberg book, so to speak, story wise. And then when you look what he can do with Lincoln. Right? And then when you look, he'll do Ready Player One, or and then he'll do The Post. Jurassic Park, Schindler's List, Saving Private Ryan, Munich. And for the longest time, he couldn't get his due, because everybody thought, oh, he ruined cinema with movies like Jaws and Close Encounters. And then when he tries to be serious, oh, he can't handle The Color Purple. There was criticism all his life, pretty much up until people started paying more attention in Jurassic Park, and then, of course, Schindler's List. He'd been nominated. He was like the Susan Lucci. He'd be nominated. His movies would be nominated. Never, but was never invited to the after parties. He would never get the award until. But then he's finally gotten his due, and people take him seriously, and actors want to work with him. So
yeah, and I have to, like, Spielberg's is amazing, but can we also talk just about the writing of this movie?
Sure,
because I think that's an amazing story too. Talk about a fast turnaround. I mean, we had first time screenwriter Liz Hannah actually wrote this as a spec script, because it was her boyfriend who encouraged her to write the story of Cay Grant, because she read Cay Grant's actual personal biography, fell in love with the person that Cay Grant is, and wrote a spec script. And then it was her writing manager, Liz Hannah's writing manager, mm-hmm. that leaked the script. And it got out, and there was a whole auction bidding war, and it was actually Sony Pictures' Amy Pascal who won the auction, called up Liz Hannah, and it was Amy Pascal who handed the script to Steven Spielberg. So that's just a fast turnaround in and of itself for just the story. And the story, this script, was number two on the blacklist.
Yeah.
So it was already, well, and for being the first time screenwriter for Liz Hannah, I mean, that's an amazing story just to tell.
Yeah, and she was totally inspired by Graham and Bradley. She read, it was Bradley's memoir that actually sort of kind of, she figured out her roadmap and how to proceed in writing the story with the two of them. And that is amazing. But also, you know, we also talk about the collaborative process here. So she has this script, and then it's Spielberg who, when he comes on board, he was like, okay, this is fantastic, but I want somebody to, it was his suggestion to bring in Josh Singer, and then Singer I forget her name already. Liz, like they worked together and they had an amazing collaborative process in honing things down and where to, how to make this movie. And in a sense, they made this love story-ish between Liz and Bradley, and that their relationship too is what holds, I think, this movie and story together. And again, it, you know, Spielberg's thinking ahead, so that's why he brings in Singer. He worked on Spotlight, perfect, West Wing,
Fifth Estate,
yeah, and so. You know, the collaborative process here. Liz didn't have any hubris about herself. She didn't, yeah, okay, let's work. Yeah, we're going to work together. And they both really come out adoring each other and respecting one another's craft.
Yeah, and Liz even said that, like, she's herself is not a 55-year-old woman in 1971, but she does know what it's like to be a woman. She quotes, "I know what it's like. I know what it's like to want the truth out there, and I care about morality and ethics." So you can tell that there were moments in this movie where they're questioning, do we do this for our company, mm-hmm. even though we know it's against the law? Like, there was a lot of journalistic integrity here and there. You can absolutely.
And Singer, too, again, does his exhaustive research to ensure details were right. And Singer consulted a range of tech advisors. Chief among them was Steve Cole. He was a Washington Post veteran. So all of this just goes into the integrity of not only journalism, but the writing. If you're going to make this, you can't mess it up. And they didn't. I think the two screenwriters worked great together.
Yep. I agree.
And
it shows on screen. Speaking of the finer details, this isn't necessarily the writing, but all the phone conversations of Nixon were actually Nixon.
His voice.
That was his voice.
It's his actual voice.
Good. You know, thank God he recorded himself so we can put that in there. You know? He wasn't thinking that far ahead, but one day I'd be in an Oscar-nominated movie. At least my voice. So.
But it also just shows like how much he was involved and he knew what he was doing in making all these decisions.
Yeah.
Quite scary indeed. And the other interesting part was the Pentagon paper scenes were actually genuine props.
Yes.
No photocopies. It was the real stuff.
Right.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, authenticity. That.
Yeah, when I thought, like, from a production aspect, like I would have been fine as an actor if you even had, like, you know, fake copies of it. But the level of detail they put into the way everything worked, you mentioned just even the printing press and so forth.
Right.
It makes you feel in that time period, and we'll talk music, but even just the newsroom itself. Just the typing.
Well, there's that cacophony and the typing, which is its own beat. Since we're talking about a newspaper, Tom Hanks, who is he's a typewriter aficionado. He loves collecting old typewriters, believe it or not. In fact, he has a Twitter feed, Tom Hanks's typewriter, and it tweets out. And
that's impossible.
So he. Hanks himself was like, it was amazing to walk into those newsroom scenes and hearing all those typewriters going. He goes, I would literally nap on the couch, falling asleep to those. The typewriter is a lot different than the computer keyboard today. And it was anytime, even when you see the Richard Donner Superman, you know, when all you're listening is the typewriter sounds, of course, all the President's Men, same thing. A typewriter does have its distinct...
even Darkest Hour, we had
sure, yes, yeah, and then there's the ding of the bell, and there's that, like, you know, and
I'd want to stab all my coworkers.
Jerry Lewis,
I'm trying to concentrate. I got him on deadline. Damn it!
Jerry Lewis made a very famous comedic one-man sketch about the typing sounds. So it's very fascinating because it doesn't exist anymore today. Even the sound of the printing press and then like moving the blocks, and then how they roll it off and they throw the papers off the back of the truck. It harkens cool back to it. It's cool to, and from a historic reference, I think it's great to take some people. And, what's that? Well, that's how we used to get our news a lot from. Yeah. So,
and the cool thing, looking at it, the blacks were backwards because you're like, yes, it would have to be backwards, right. So it would appear correct on paper.
Yeah,
like even those details, like what?
And then talk about.
Well, the blocking of it, too, they had to, they made the sections out where they should go and so forth. So without being too overt about it, they gave you context of how a paper is actually made.
And printed, absolutely.
So I did appreciate that. This, since we're on the subject, I know this kind of skips forward a little bit, so we'll come back. But John Williams, that was his biggest worry of, like, where the hell are you going to play some music? All you hear is just sounds everywhere. Like, where's the music going to go?
Yeah.
He found it, and he had his 28th collaboration with Spielberg. Wow. So kudos to him.
I noticed the music when she just made the big decision. They're like, yes, it's a go.
Right.
And then they're like, all right, let's send it to the presses. And it was all just the montage of them putting everything together. Music swell, crescendo. It was brilliant. John Williams is the man. Legend.
It's their 44th year together as collaborators. 44 years, and like you said, their 29th project together.
28th.
According to press notes, the 29th, because if they, I believe, well, Sylvester's doing Ready Player One.
Yes, they might.
No. So, their work together, well, there's like a triple album of their work together. Mm-hmm. You can get it on iTunes. If you like vinyl, it's a beautiful box set. I don't have it on vinyl. But their music is beautiful together. And come on, let's face it, John Williams has made pretty much all of the best iconic movie scores that any movie lover or anybody, and even if you're not a movie lover, you can point to and know exactly what that score is. Whether it's the Indiana Jones march, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Jaws.
But even Star Wars, and that he has a whole career outside of Spielberg.
Absolutely. Before, he'd done movies like The Towering Inferno or Earthquake. The man's been around forever. He's done television, like news scores. He was our beloved conductor of the Boston Pops for a while. He took over after the much beloved Arthur Fiedler. The man, the man works, and his tapestry of orchestration is beautiful. If you listen to him enough, yes, he does borrow from his own scores. There is even some at the beginning of the opening of The Post, but I was very surprised that The Post didn't get nominated. I thought The Post would have gotten nominated over Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And Star Wars got nominated over The Post. And I love The Last Jedi score as well, but I just felt they were going to go with the more original. Like, this isn't based on his previous ones. Everybody knows Star Wars theme. But The Post...
It also depends how they were pushing it. Yeah, you know,
I guess. But the way it seemed, too, though, was that he was going to be for The Post. So it was interesting. They could have nominated from both, but I think, if memory is correct, he has the most nominations of anybody ever for the Academy, for an Academy Award. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Even more than Meryl Streep.
Even more than Meryl Streep.
Alrighty. So going sort of back to it, you talked about, Marissa, how you appreciate the colors and so forth. Interestingly enough, this is his first movie since War of the Worlds that used an aspect ratio of 1.85 to 1, which is to say overall, not as widescreen as it could have been. It's more, it's not squarish, obviously, but
it's more of a box.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And while that's a very technical jargon, what I liked about it is you really got to see the newsroom. Like, it allowed you kind of to see both spaces fairly well in terms of width and height, you know, and I appreciated that. It made it feel, I don't know, homey, if I had to give it a word.
Well, it's I'm glad you brought that up because it was a means of 70s filmmaking. And they actually shot on 35 millimeter. One of my favorite uses,
loves films.
Right? And you know, he wanted that early 70s style, and it was all about color, temperature, and palette. And then it was about the writing, or I should say, the lighting, and how the costumes were reflected. The movie, and I didn't really notice this too much, but the pair being have the hardest time saying is Janusz Kaminski, his longtime now cinematographer, and Spielberg. They focused on reflective surfaces, and they say that the movie is about reflecting back on our history. And Janusz and Steven work together to try to highlight reflections, for example, in the ceiling of the newsroom or even a phone booth, which became part of the storytelling. He also uses my favorite technique is this, what do they call it, like the dioptic lens. So where the people in the foreground and the people in the background are all in focus, that you can see them sharply and clearly. Another one of my, we had a picture up there which showed it, a perfect example of that. You know, and it doesn't, when Spielberg does it, it doesn't come off as being a trick.
No.
It comes up as being organic to the story.
But it also shows, you know, to show everybody in focus shows that everybody in that newsroom is important.
Sure.
They all play their important roles.
Yeah.
Well, they were. Even the guy who's just randomly, I don't know what article he's working on, but he gets that stack.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh boy, what do I do? Mm-hmm. All right. And just his timidness in walking in there, and they were busy, so he's like, all right, well, let me go to this guy first. Right. I think I have something.
Right.
Well, okay, you got something.
You got something.
So, 100% that played into it.
Hey, Marissa, I wanted to. So, when we were talking about the Spielberg documentary, one of the things that I believe we both found fascinating is the way that Spielberg, where he sets up a camera, like he knows where he wants the shot to be. And it was interesting coming off of Ready Player One, where you really do have to. Where the camera sits in order, because you're going to put in the special effects. Spielberg himself was like, you know, I relish the freedom of shooting a character-focused drama after a special effects pick. He goes, I could trade in intricate storyboarding that such films demand for more free form. In terms of where we put the camera, I kind of played it by ear, which is really fun for me, and I love doing that. And if you watch that documentary, that's when he really does have a huge smile on his face, when he's able to put the camera where he wants it to get whatever shot angle. And you saw that here in this movie.
Yeah, I think one of the key shots that like really stuck with me in this film was when we had Bradley and Kay. And they were walking to that restaurant place. There was movement, and then it literally follows them. They're sitting down. It goes in like a big semicircle kind of direction, and they're sitting down. And then they go off on a 5-minute dialogue, and it was all in one shot. And I think that was just – it was amazing acting just for like keeping up with the momentum of just the camera movement. But from going from movement to sitting down and following the same story.
And then you go, how does he not rehearse?
Yeah.
Well, he tells them what to do, and then we do it.
And then we do it. I'm going to track you, yeah.
Well, I also think rehearsing is also, it can take on different meanings. It's oftentimes we talk about movies where they rehearsed for 4 months before shooting. It's like, sure. Okay, well.
Yeah, we did that.
Listen, you guys know what to do. You guys study the characters, do your homework, come to set, and we'll shoot it.
Right.
Good? Yeah. Great.
Sometimes, rehearsing is also for the technical aspects, the blocking of the camera. Like, Mother, as crazy as a movie that was. Or Birdman, where it was all camera movements. Sometimes the rehearsal's for the production side, not for the actors.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. All right. Well, fascinating aspect that I appreciated was as they were shooting this, it was being cut, and then 2 weeks after, they called a wrap. We have the movie edited. Insane. 2 weeks. That's better than our friend who did All the Money in the World. Why am I blanking on his name? You know.
Oh, who. Yeah, Ridley Scott.
That's it.
Yeah, Ridley. Ridley Scott. Yeah. Well,
that's insane.
Go back and redo a lot of things.
That's insane.
I mean, good.
Granted, I'm sure you know they made a couple of changes and stuff like that afterwards. But to have the overall movie be in its near completed form just 2 weeks after finishing, that's insane.
Yeah.
That shows everyone's hard work all around. And I don't mean, you know, yes, in terms of the hours put in, but also just the mechanism of the beast, if you will.
Yeah, and it goes, Spielberg likes to use the same people. I believe it was Michael Caine.
And so he collaborated for the first time, so, but yes, Michael Caine, he's done so many of his movies, if not all.
And then, you know, he even used Rick Carter, who is his production designer. So all these people understand each other's language
and workflow.
And again, I think to Spielberg's point where he said about coming off of Ready Player One, when it's a more humanistic drama, I think for him it's like, whew, yeah, I don't have to worry too much about special effects here. I already have it in my head, and I don't have to worry too much about post, what I'm putting it in and how I can move a camera angle or something. So,
what you see is what you get.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Pretty much.
So, absolutely. And we've said it, but it deserves to be said again. 9 months from script to final cut. That's
incredible.
Amazing.
You know, just the low. And by the way, I could buy that if it was like a shitty movie. It's not a shitty movie. No, that's the testament of it, because there's a lot of like crappy movies out here. This movie was made in less than a month, shot, written, and edited. It looks like that. So, 100%. 100%. Any other fun facts about the production side before we now shift gears into the legacy, promotion, and box office?
Well, you know, again, I think Rick Carter in his production design and doing the post newsroom, they really used about 10 photographs to guide him, but they didn't really have photos that would show everything, so it was partly an impression of what it would have been like. And the first thing you see in the post newsroom at the time was vast, transparent place. It was completely open, a hodgepodge of desks, typewriters. It was a time. It's a time that doesn't. We're leading into an end of an era when you're talking about reporting, and I think that they captured that. You got that mayhem of a newsroom. I felt as if I was there between the editing, the sound editing, obviously, the sights and sounds of what was going on, and all these people just seemed very comfortable in their environment. So, you know, and they were he's working with mid-century typewriters. So this gentleman, Burton, scoured the earth for the Xerox machine that Daniel Ellsberg uses. And
oh, yeah, that copy.
It was a Xerox 914, and apparently it just really wasn't that easy to find. And why would it be?
Because it's so efficient.
I've been watching this film, you know, like, and I, when he's actually copying the thing, I was like, wow, that's an old machine. I literally had that thought. That's an old machine to hit the copy button.
It's so old, it copied in pencil. So it's...
That's why it took months.
Yeah, I was... That patience, like, thank the Lord they actually had the patience to go through that. Because I didn't even have patience just watching it. Like, they had some fast cuts around it. And they showed the monotony of it all, but I was like, still, oh my god!
Oh my god. Yeah.
Right. I like the build up though. Like the one scene where Odenkirk, when his character goes to get the papers from Daniel Elfrick, and it's like so secretive in that hotel motel room. But the lighting was so harsh, and so you knew that like something was up. But all the papers spread out on the bed and all throughout the rooms. Compared to now, all the papers now being read, spread out in the house, it was just like, whoa, thousands of pages.
And talk about thousands. Talk about a continuity nightmare. They had to like match up because none of it was in any kind of order, like whatsoever. Again, that just goes to their tenacity and what they had to do to pull it all together. I did like that scene that was on the plane. I mean, it's in the trailer. But it was no less entertaining watching it within the full scope of the movie about buckles it up. Oh, yeah. What do you have in there? Secret documents. And you're like, yeah.
And no one questions it.
Nope.
Okay, good.
Yeah, okay.
Well, you know, listen, I think he played it off so well that she's like, okay, it's a joke, but, you know, obviously it's something important.
Right.
Anywho. All right. Well, the post premiered at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. on December 14th, and thereafter it began a limited release in December of 2022.
December 22nd, 2017. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that way it made it eligible for the Oscars, and then it got a wide release January 12th.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Let me ask you guys this. What do you guys think about Tom Hanks not wanting to come to the White House for a special screening with Donald Trump?
He didn't want the movie to be shown. I didn't know if we were going to go down that route. But
I just ask because, I mean, I don't want to get too political, but I think, like, if what the message of the movie that you're trying to spread, you know, go to the person who you think would need it the most.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know. Again, that's just my quick thought on it.
Like, it's his prerogative whether he wants to see a movie with whoever he wants or not. I mean,
where they screen it.
Yeah, where, and like, if he mentions, like, I don't want to see it with Donald Trump, then fine. Okay, sure.
I mean, it's his choice. But,
right.
Exactly.
But
I mean, but was it screened for the White House at the White House?
I'm surprised Meryl Streep didn't say that. She hates Trump.
Yeah. You know? So, I mean, what do we know?
But that would be the irony to me is Meryl Streep with Donald Trump making him watch her movie. Like, do it.
Yeah.
That would have been great.
That would be a great movie just in and of itself.
Got put together. I mean, that is another movie. But, you know, it's interesting because when it opened in December 22nd, only 9 theaters it opened at. It came in at number 20. and it did $526,000. So, but currently, domestically, it's near 70, which is, you know, nothing to sneeze at considering the movie. You know, it's not a superhero movie, and it is a little bit of history, right? Mm-hmm. So, but worldwide, we're also looking at over $107 million. And I think we talked about Darkest Hours worldwide being $107 million. So, obviously, I think, it's a good niche, then, that people do want to see it. It tells a nice, it tells a good part of history. I think it's multi-level, multifaceted. And, you know, considering its production budget was about $50 million, and my guess, Fox has probably dumped $50-plus million into. I mean, they're doing an Academy push, so that always costs money. We'll see how it pays off. In the end, bottom line right now is it's got the publicity of being, well, in today's world, and being an Oscar-nominated picture.
Right. Yeah. They definitely were pushing for the awards because I remember when this movie came out, limited, because we're here in L.A., we get it first, but it was already nominated for Golden Globes.
True.
And no one was able to see this movie yet. And I'm like, come on, you can't already put this up for awards just because it has Spielberg, Hanks, and Streep in it. Like, and I just remember thinking, it's like, no one has seen it yet because it's literally in no theaters. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, they're making the awards. Yeah. But watching it, I mean, yeah, it's a solid film, sure.
Sure. And through the performances, I mean, you could see why it was nominated. Will it win anything? Meh, we'll see. Really, no. But, you know, it's... I just think that... I hate to say that with a word it's an important movie, because that means, oh, it's a movie you have to take medicine with. I think it's only important in the time frame of which it's now released. And they made a conscious effort to get this movie out, like, now, because of everything that's going on. There was no mistake on the release dates for this movie and getting it out when it is. So... Now, can you look at this as a political movie? Sure, you can make almost anything political these days. But I think the important thing here is thematically. What did it mean to our future history from a politics side, but from a journalistic side? Because if things had gone the other way, could you imagine how hard it would be to get that back, that political, that journalistic freedom back?
Well, it's here's the scarier notion, right? There's a saying that I've heard oftentimes. I don't know if you guys have heard it, but there's a guy who goes through a city and he's like, "Wow, this city has 10,000 hidden cameras." Oh yeah? Well, how many did you miss? Right. You know what I mean? Like, if they're supposed to be hidden and you were able to count 10,000, like, there's obviously way more than you ever thought.
Right.
And so, where I'm drawing a parallel to that is. The scary notion is that, okay, we caught this part of history, but what atrocities, if you want to call them that,
right,
are we not able to catch? Mm-hmm. So, and I don't, you know, I'm not trying to just say in today's day and age and just make it all about today, but just in general and then from then till now and ongoing.
Yeah.
And I do think this movie, yes, it's very relevant to today's day and age, but again, the irony being, I think it'll be relevant 20 years from now, 30 years from now.
Like, yeah, I agree. But it's not just for the press and journalism too. I really think it's relevant today for women empowerment. Again, she was head of a newspaper. She was head of the Washington Post, which has a name for itself today. That paper, I didn't realize how dire straits that publication was back then. And to me, that was, wow, that's crazy that that paper could have gone away. And it being led by a woman who made this seminal decision, I think is inspiring in today's relevant market. So, and I'm not even sure, like, I think when everything was coming together with the script, I know that's one of the reasons Spielberg picked it. Politics yeah. aside, you still have a really good story here, too, yeah. with Kathy Griffin.
And I think the third sort of takeaway is also, you know, yes, journalism, yes, women, but also in terms of a voice for the American people, when you look at the ideals of democracy, well, okay. we're not supposed to have dictators and so forth, and I'm not saying we necessarily do, but there's supposed to be checks and balances, and the American people have a right to be heard and sort of what they want should go, and sometimes it doesn't always go that way, mm-hmm. and they aren't heard.
Right, yeah. And I think just the backdrop of the Vietnam War, which was so controversial
absolutely.
In and of itself, with having the reveal of these papers kind of validating the fact that everyone's like, yeah, we shouldn't have gone to war mm-hmm. when you knew how terrible it was.
Right.
Like, and I think just that relevance, too, also hits with people because people are still alive that affected them back
yeah,
then.
Absolutely.
So, and the people who are seeing this movie are the people who were alive back
mm-hmm.
then and are still now.
Yeah, and I don't know about the audience makeup of the theater where you saw it. This I can say.
Generally, it was over 66% of the audience right. was over 35.
I guarantee you I was the youngest person in my theater. The youngest.
Yeah, and I was. I saw this movie in East Greenbush. It was during a snowstorm. So it wasn't overly crowded, but the crowd that was in there... it was a bit older, but I will say this: as walking out, all I heard around me, that was a great movie, wasn't it? Wasn't that amazing how they showed papers being done? Wasn't that an amazing movie? And I heard that multiple times because coming out with a dozen or so people that made it out that night. So that was like, I was like, okay, so it wasn't just me. I really enjoyed this too, and I was like, yeah, that was a good movie.
Well, it was an A on CinemaScore, 88 percent on Rotten Tomatoes with 301 reviews as of now, or last I checked. And, you know, people overall liked it. The great direction from Spielberg, great ensemble cast, because it is, you know, as much as Hanks and Streep are getting praise for it, to me it's an ensemble, it's an orchestra of people.
Even the two guys that play the lawyers.
Fake Matt Damon. Right? I mean, he's a little chubby Matt Damon.
I thought the same thing, because he's also in the USS Callister episode of Black Mirror, and I was like, his sounds terrible. He's the poor man's version of Matt Damon.
Yeah, he was in Battleship too, I think.
That makes sense.
Fair enough. So yeah, a lot of people are liking it, and obviously nominated tons in various categories. So we'll see what happens.
And much like Darkest Hours too, I think ultimately it's a crowd pleaser. You know, it's a movie that people will walk away, and it's a crowd pleasing movie, which, well, I'm all for that in this day and age. I like to come out of a movie feeling pretty good.
Go see Paddington 2.
Go see Paddington 2.
That's a real crowd pleaser, telling you for sure.
So, yeah, and then, you know, I know you like quotes, Bill. Sure. So I have this one comes from Catherine Graham, where she says, you know, some people enjoy competition and dust-ups, and I wish I did, but I don't. But once you have started down a path, then I think you have to move forward. You can't give up.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty much what this movie is ultimately about.
Those are great words to end on. Indeed. All right. Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to us and hearing our thoughts. As always, you can comment, let us know your opinion. And furthermore, if you haven't already done so, what are you doing? Subscribe. That way you get all the episodes. You don't have to listen to all of them. I'm sure you don't see all the movies we cover, but hey, when we cover a movie that you have seen, check us out. Or, you know, even in the future, you don't have to go rush to the movie theater necessarily, although we do encourage it. Check it out when you have seen it. And furthermore, the biggest thing you guys can do for us is spread the joy that we're out here doing what we do. So if you have cinephile friends, let them know we're out here. And you know what? Let them check it out. Maybe they like us, maybe they don't, but at least they know about us. In the meantime, where can people interact with you, Marissa?
Everyone can follow me ever at SerafiniTV.
And Dimitri?
At DMovies1701.
Look at that. That's not the year he was born.
No, but although people have commented that it could be.
All right. And I'm at Phil Svitek. We are on at the Popcorn Talk. That's the network. And of course, we are Anatomy of Movie. Thank you guys, as always. Check out all the great shows we've done in the past. And we will continue to do great episodes moving forward. In fact, Marissa and I, just today, we will be covering Call Me By Your Name. My name is Phil. and, of course, we've got other stuff in the works.
Black Panther?
Well, we got Black Panther. We've got Three Billboards still to go. So lots of stuff for us to still cover, both new and kind of in the Oscar realm of things that have come out already.
Best picture films.
Yes.
Yes.
So lots to talk about. Thank you guys, as always. We'll see you next time on another Anatomy of a Movie.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.